Sorry for the delay. How is everybody tonight? Cold. We have our first major storm of the winter. And as a result of that, tonight will be an abbreviated class, because I know we have better things to do than snow all ice or something like that. Maybe even a hot cup of cocoa or something fun. So what we'll do tonight, hey guys, you're talking, I can't. What we're going to do tonight is we're going to do a review for the midterm, which is next week. And I'll send you why you're very good. The review slides will be up on the internet, as well as class 5 and 6 have not been put up yet. They will be put up in the next couple days. But everything you're going to need to know for the midterm is on these slides tonight. They will be posted tonight. So you can download them and play with them. Much of them are from the previous slides and previous lectures. So if you've been here, you've been in class, you're all going to do beautifully. Remember, the midterm is not intended to be a trick. It is 60 multiple choice, fill in the blank, circle on the Scantron questions. Now, just for giggles, I also add 6 more questions. They are extra credit. This is not the SAT. If you get them wrong, they don't count against you. So guess if you don't know the answer. You got a 25% chance of being right. And all it'll do is help your score. This is the test of my hot little hand. As I said, it is 60 questions. If you have a question during the test, raise your hand. Although the test says it has a time limit of an hour and a half, few people will ever take that long to get through this. I suspect it'll be a fraction of that. But if you need more time than an hour and a half, John, what do I do? Victor, what do I do? You get as much time as you need. Okay? I go home when you go home. If you need more than an hour and a half, you take more than an hour and a half. Okay? We're not going to have a stopwatch on you. Okay? So just recognize we're here for you. We want you to succeed. Okay. The test, like the class, it's been broken up into 6 different parts. Why do you think that is?
6 classes.
Very good. Because there are 6 classes, not rocket science. We've broken it up into 6 parts. Tonight's review is broken up into 6 parts. It's probably taken an hour or so to get through it. And it's the whole class in one thing. When you go to study, use the review sheets. Because guess what? Those review sheets are going to tell you everything. It's on the test, it's in the review sheets, okay? So go to those. They're a nice crib note. I do believe in crib notes. I did brief cases when I was in law school. Because it helps you, okay? Okay, let's get started. Before I do, though, any questions? Yes? In the back row. I got to jump up front to hear
The audio
will be up. The audio will be up. By this weekend, we'll have all the audio. And if you can't fall asleep this weekend, listen to it. Guaranteed cure for insomnia. Okay? The audio will be up. And the audio for tonight's class, if it works, and I hope it does, we're doing iPad audio tonight. Let's see if that works. As long as that, the little recorder that I've been using before wasn't picking it up as well as I wanted it to. So we're shifting gears here, okay? Okay, any other questions on anything at all? Yes?
Are these just the review sheets up here?
Yes, just the review sheets. We're not going to go through that. I think that's why it says midterm review, right? Those are the review sheets. They will be posted in class 7. So you go to the website, robfarley.org, click on class 7, and guess what you'll get? You got it. These review sheets. Okay. Let's get started. Okay. Last time we spoke about
types of corporations, pre-incorporation. Those are the activities you do before you actually file your certificate. It's not magic. Sometimes you have to do some things to set up the corporation before you actually file. You have to light up some investors. You've got to get some contracts. You may even have to buy a truck, an office, do a lease. That's the pre-incorporation items. And remember, they can be ratified by the corporation after you do them. Now, just think of this. If you've had a sole proprietorship or a partnership for years and want to convert that into a corporation, you can. And all your operations as a sole proprietorship or the partnership can be rolled into the corporation through ratification. Board of directors are the ones who ratify. Okay. We talked last time about how you form a corporation. Remember, you got to turn around and write up that certificate. There's certain things that have to be in the certificate of corporation, who the incorporators are. Remember, they have to be over 18. They have to have capacity. That means they can't be of diminished capacity. They can't be intoxicated at the time they sign it. They can't turn around and be underage. They can't be mentally deficient. You have to list the office of where the corporation's going to be. You have to list the purpose of the corporation. Generally, under the business corporation law, they allow a broad purpose to make money, to operate a business for profit. You can just put that in there. That's legitimate. The more you want to restrict the actions of the corporation, the more you put that in there. You can say, we're going to run a donut shop. Okay, that's all you'll do. Okay? But remember, if you try to do more than that, then you can get in trouble with your corporation for exceeding the scope of what your certificate of incorporation tells you. That's called an ultra vires act. Again, Latin, beyond the scope, beyond the veil. Okay? Property of corporations, remember, unlike a partnership, who owns the property of a partner? Anybody?
Partners.
Right. Partners own the property of a partnership, and so the sole proprietorship.
If I'm going to Bob's Donut Shop and I'm not incorporated, I own all the things. I own the mixers. I own the donuts. I own the weed on the shelves. Everything. Okay?
Now, if I'm incorporated, however, all that property that you have to do to run the business, it belongs to the corporation, not to the people who've invested in it. Because remember, a corporation is a separate person under the law. Corpus, that's what it means, body. It's a separate person. So the property of a corporation belongs to that person. And lastly, we talked about the powers of the corporation. What can they do? They can do what is legal in advancing their corporate purpose. It's as simple as that. Okay? How does a corporation act? They have to act through agents. Because a corporation is not a human being. And only human beings can take action. So as a result of that, the corporation acts through agents. Principally employees, people who are hired and paid by that corporation. Could be a volunteer, but it's unlikely. Okay. Midterm review. Got to look back to look forward. Like that rearview mirror thing going on there? Okay. Part one, general principles. Okay. Remember, this is a course in law. For those of you who have been asleep all semester, I apologize if I've been making you do that. Realize this is a course of law, so you understand what's going on here, you're going to understand that framework. What is the law? We have a simple definition. Law is the rules by which civilization is ordered. If you know that definition, you're part of the way home, because you know what's happening with law. Okay? This is a course in law. This is a course that tells you how businesses intersect with the law. and how the law recognizes those business entities, whether it's a sole proprietorship, whether it's a partnership, whether it's a corporation, or other type of corporate entities. Remember that definition. You'll see it again. Laws, the rules by which civilization is ordered. What are the components of law? You got rules that are pronounced, laid down, or issued by a controlling authority. They have to be long-lasting. A law that is only there for a microsecond is no good. If it's on changing circumstances, nobody's going to know what it is, and hence they can't follow it. It's got to be enforceable and followed. Long before you guys were around here, in 1973, the President of the United States decided that he was going to lower the speed limit in the United States of America to save gasoline. How many people do you think drove 55? Almost no one. The National Transportation Safety Board, the people who try and keep us safe on roadways, did a study saying that the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was actually an impediment to safety because no one was following it and they were making up their own speeds. So Congress turned around in the 1980s and said, let's raise it to 65. Because most of the cars were driving between 65 and 70. That was a law, the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. It was a bad law because nobody was following it. When they raised it to 65, far more people were following it, although not everybody does. Okay. What do modern laws include? What categories do you have? First, you're going to see this, constitutions. Constitutions are the highest level of law. The Constitution not only sets out what the laws are, but it also provides for the structure of governance. It tells you how your government is set up. That's what a Constitution does. Next, you have statutes. Statutes are laws that are enacted by either a state legislature on the state level or by Congress on the federal level. Okay? Once they're elected, they turn around and represent us pursuant to the Constitution. Remember that Constitution sets the framework. The state legislature or the Congress enacts those laws. Those are called statutes. Case law. When a judge decides a case, he writes it down. That's called a decision. And it's put in a book. That's called a reporter. That's case law. Now, case law can be law on its own, but most often it merely amplifies a statute or a principle of law. That's the next level. Next, you have regulations. Regulations are how state agencies or a federal agency, like an Environmental Protection Agency, like Health and Human Services, interpret a statute when they are going out to enforce it. Regulations are promulgated, that means they're enacted, by that state agency. There's rules and procedures by which they are promulgated. On the federal level and on the state, there's procedures for enacting regulations. On the federal level, it's known as the Federal Procedure Act, and on the state level, it's the State Procedure Act. Administrative procedures are done pursuant to those two acts. Administrative law is a whole body of law. It's on regulations. Regulations in conflict to a statute get struck down. Constitutions are the highest level of law. Then you have regulations. And lastly, on the bottom, you have executive orders. Executive orders are when a president or a governor tell his employees what he wants or she wants them to do. Executive orders are the lowest level of law. It's merely a directive by an executive. Case law, where that fits in amongst this, is a very touchy place. Watch. Because under the doctrine of judicial review, courts actually review what the Constitution says it is. John Marshall, Chief Justice of the United States,
came up with the doctrine of judicial review. So you can say that case law has no level of law. You can say it's the highest, depending on what they're reviewing. Okay? What a case law is supposed to do is tell you what the law says. Sometimes they make their own. Okay. We have three branches of government, both the federal and the state. You have the executive, which are the federal, the president. You have the Congress, which is the legislative, and the courts. You have the governor, state legislature, and the courts on the state level. The federal court system. You will see this. Promise you. Highest court, the federal courts, the Supreme Court of the United States. Located in Washington, D.C., right across the street from the Capitol building. Okay? That's the highest level appeals court. It does have original jurisdiction under certain circumstances, but very few. Okay? Then you have a mid-level appeal court, the United States Court of Appeals. They're called circuit courts. The one in which we sit is located in New York City. We sit in the Second Circuit. But there are a dozen circuits across the country. Okay? Lowest level federal court, federal trial court, is the United States District Court. United States District Court is located here in Albany. It's in the James Foley Courthouse, right on Broadway, right at the bottom of the hill in downtown Albany. That's the lowest level federal court. Okay? Now, when you get to the state courts, they're upside down. Supreme Court, the state system, is the lowest level court. I know it doesn't sound that way, but it is. Under New York state law, the Supreme Court is the trial court. It is not a high-level court. It's the lowest level state court. It's higher than some other courts, county courts, local courts, but it's the lowest level state court. Then you have the appellate division of the Supreme Court. Then you have the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals is the highest court in New York State. That's located in Albany, right downtown, right at Caddy Corner to the Capitol. Okay. Remember, we're dealing with law business organizations. We're going to deal with sole proprietorships. We talked about those. Partnerships and corporations. You understand the law, and it's in a relation to these entities, that's the court. That's where we are. Now, the law of business organizations. We have someplace better to go. The law of business organizations is state law. It's not federal law by and large. There are some intersections where federal statutes come into play, but by and large, you're talking about state law when you talk about law of business organizations. Okay? Okay. Agency. The law of agency, as we talked before, involves representing a principal. You're acting on behalf of someone else. What is this defined as? A fiduciary relationship. It's all about relationships. You're representing someone. Fiduciary means that you have a duty to that person. Remember, we talked about these duties. Fiduciary relationship means you have a duty to that principal, and the principal has a duty back to the agent. Okay? It's created by express or implied contract. Guys, I'm going to say this once. Okay? I don't want people walking in and out of the class constantly. If you got to go someplace, I understand that. But there has been an incredible amount of movement in the back of the classroom in the last three classes. I want it stopped. Clear? Don't talk while I am. I get you out of here on time. I love you all. But this is not, I was just talking about people coming in and out of the classroom repeatedly. Okay? Please find a seat and stay there. I do not want people coming in and out. It is distracting to the entire class. This is not a training station. Okay? Okay.
When you're talking about agency, you work on behalf of a principal. That actions that you take by that person, it's the same as if they did it themselves. It's the nature of the fiduciary relationship. Okay? You bind them by words or actions. What are the elements? Fiduciary relationship created by express or implied contract. It's a two-step dance on how you create this relationship. You can either create it by agreement, that's either express or implied, or it's by law. Under some circumstances, you're automatically an agent of somebody by operational law. It automatically happens. You don't have to agree to it, it just happens. Okay? Which one party, the agent, acts on behalf of the other party, the principal, and binds that principal via their authority. Okay, I got to say this one more time. Excuse me, what's your name? Why are we behind? Okay, please have a seat. I understand it's inclement weather. I've made this announcement before. I'm not going to belabor it with the class. Please come see me after class. Okay? Okay. You bind it by words or actions. That's how it's done. Okay. Now, you cannot have an agency relationship when what you are doing requires your personal performance. I'll give you an example. Let's say I am a magnificent singer. I'm Billy Joel, okay? And I'm able to entertain millions of people. People pay boku bucks to come and see me sing. You really can't hire an agent to go sing for you if they don't feel like singing. Why? Because people are paying for that individual performance. Okay? When a contract calls for your individual performance, it is not subject to agency. Okay? Now, if I turn around and I'm Billy Joel and I want to buy a car, I can hire an agent to do that because nobody cares and it doesn't require my personal performance to buy that car. So I can hire an agent so I can go out to California and sing the songs and my car gets bought. Okay? But when I'm there doing something that requires my personal performance, I have to do it. Agency does not apply. Okay? Okay. Capacity. Remember, this is a contractual relationship, but there are two distinctions from a traditional contract. One is, in every contract, by and large, you have to have capacity, both parties. With an agency, only the principal has to have it. The agent doesn't necessarily have to have capacity. Okay? Principal, however, has to have capacity. They have to be of sound mind. They have to be of 18 years of age, the age of majority. Okay? Agents generally do not need to have capacity. Okay? Unincorporated associations have been deemed not to have capacity. Why? They're not an entity under the law. They can't hire someone. As a result of that, they cannot be involved in agency. Unincorporated organizations do not. Now, if I'm a member of that organization, I can be a principal. But you're bound to that individual, not to the organization. Okay? So if you have an unincorporated organization, and there's a lot of those, okay? The Westfeld Homeowners Association. Nobody's incorporated. It's just a bunch of people come together and talk about how great their neighborhood are. Okay? A lot of those things out there. But they cannot turn around and have an agent work on behalf of that organization. Now, the president, when they all get together, they elect the president. They elect a president. That president can go out there and hire it as someone as their agent. But it works for the president individually, not for the organization. Okay? Okay. Consent, there's got to be an agreement unless it's by operation of law. The second issue, where the traditional contract relationship does not apply, is consideration. When you have a contract with someone else, it's termed as consideration is a necessary element. It's a promise for a promise. You're doing something or giving something in return for it. Not under agency. You can have a volunteer agent. Okay? There does not have to be consideration. Now, if there is, and 95% of all agencies do have, can you come see me after class, please? 95% of all agencies do have consideration and do involve it. You have a duty as a principal to pay that consideration. Okay? That's one of your duties as a principal. But it's not necessary to have it. Okay? There is no requirement that an agency contract be in writing. Does not have to be written. Like everything in the law, this does have exceptions. But by and large, there is no written contract required. Okay? Okay. How do you create the agency relationship? As we talked about, two modes, by act of the parties or by operation of law. Act of the parties, four ways that the parties can act. They can give you actual authority. That means they directly communicate. The principal goes up to the agent and says, I want to hire you as my agent, and I'm giving you the authority to do what I'm asking you to do. I want you to go out and buy a car for me, and that's your job. And I'm going to pay you 5% of the value of the car to be able to do that. Okay? That is actual authority. I'm actually telling you what I need. Apparent authority. The principal conveys to a third party, orally or in writing, to indirectly authorize the agent. I tell Fred to tell Jim that I want to hire him as the agent. It is giving the authority, but it's apparent authority. Inherent authority is the third one. You actually authorize the agent to act, but they perform acts beyond what you tell them to. Okay? Lastly, you ratify something an agent does. As long as it's legal, you can do this. An agent goes out, even though you never asked him to do it, and bought you a wonderful car because he knew you were looking for it, and he turned around and said, oh, fine, that's great. I'll pay you for the car. Okay? I'll give you 5% on top. You can ratify what an agent does. Okay? That's the last method. Okay. Two ways by operation of law. One is estoppel. The law may impose an agency relationship under the doctrine of fairness, that it would only be fair to do this. Okay? It's an equitable entity. That is not frequent. It's not frequent. Statute. Certain laws impose an agency relationship. Okay? One of the example is to appoint an agent who uses the Secretary of State for service of process under certain circumstances. Okay? It's a statute. That statute authorizes that state entity to receive service of process. That's when you sue someone. Okay? Okay. How do you terminate agency? Lots of ways. One, you say you can be my agent for 6 months. What happens after 6 months? Agency's over. Why? Because you agreed that it only be for a specified time period. Most real estate agents have a time frame in their contract in which they get to sell the house. And anything beyond that, the agency's left. Okay? You can do the same thing, only instead of a measure of time, you say it by a happening of an event. Okay? It's not a time event, it's the occurrence of something. Okay? I turn around and say, you can sell my car to the highest bidder so long as you get X dollars, until I go to California. Because if I decide to go to California, I'm going to need the car, and I don't want you to sell. Okay? You can do that. You can put that on the date. Okay? Okay.
breach of an agent's fiduciary duty. All of a sudden, the agent is double dealing. You go out and hire an agent to purchase a car for you. Instead, that agent buys the car for himself because he got such a sweet deal and told you, I can't turn around and find the car you want. Okay? That can breach his duty to you. The agency can be ended as a result of that. It's misconduct. Okay? Change in circumstances. What you went out and ordered that agent to do can't be done anymore. I turned around and hired you to buy me Billy Joel tickets. Billy Joel's come down with laryngitis, and he's not performing at the concert anymore. Okay? The event's not going to happen. Change in business conditions. Change in laws. All of a sudden, and we talked about this, one day I'm a retailer in beer. Next day, prohibition passes. Can't do that anymore. It's not a valid agency contract anymore. Circumstances change because of law. I go insolvent. Unilateral act of the principal or agent. If I'm the agent or if I'm the principal and one of us dies, that terminates it. Okay? Or if I'm the principal and I go insane. Okay? Dissolution of a corporation or a partnership if they are the ones who are hiring you, because remember, they can be principals too. Guess what? That goes away too. Okay. What agencies can't go away? If you turn around and the subject matter of the agency goes to the agent, if he has an interest or she has an interest in what the agency is to accomplish, if that's how they're getting paid, you can't do away with it. Okay? If I hire you as a realtor, I can't just turn around and say goodbye, forget it, I got a buyer over here, I'm going to fire you so I don't have to pay your commission, right? You have an interest in that. You're getting a commission on the property, so I can't terminate it. Okay? Okay, apparent authority. This is where the principal holds out an agent to be their agent, but they never gave them the actual inherent authority. Okay? So I turn around and I say, I want you to know that everyone in this class, Chris, and I've just hired Chris as my agent. I've never talked to Chris before in my life. Chris and I have not met here. You know what I'm saying, okay? And I tell everyone here that Chris is now authorized as my agent to go out and buy gold for me at any time, okay? If he goes out and buys gold, I got to go out and pay for it. Why? Because I held him out to the whole free world that he was my agent for that purpose. Similarly, I'm standing here and Chris makes an announcement in my class that he has been retained by me to go out and buy gold. I say nothing. I just stand there and let him say it. But it's very evident to me and to the whole world that I heard him say it and I said nothing. I'm going to be held responsible for that agency. Now, if I was out of the room at the time he said it and I don't know anything, then no agency, okay? It's a holding out doctrine. Either I do it as a principal, or you do it as an agent, and I say nothing and it should have, okay? Okay. And it comes down to a reasonable reliance by a third party. Okay. Ratification. This is when you do the act, and later you come back. Couple things. First, the prospective principal is the only one who can ratify. An agent can't ratify. The agent is the one who's going out there and doing it on their own. It's only the prospective principal that can ratify. That prospective principal, like every other principal, has to have capacity. Okay? And they must accept the entire transaction. They can't just take a piece of what you do on their behalf. They have to do the whole McGill. Okay? The whole thing. It's got to be done. Okay, it's got to be a legal act. I can't turn around and ratify something which is unlawful. That's important. Okay, we talk about duties. Remember,
We talked about fiduciary relationship. That gets back to the fact that the two of these individuals, the agent and the principal, have duties to each other. They have obligations. It's reciprocal. Okay? What is a duty under the law? A legally recognized obligation requiring certain conduct by one person to the other. You owe something to me, and I owe something to you. Remember that element of duty came out of feudalism, and it is now incorporated in the law. What are the duties of an agent to the principal? They're pretty self-explanatory and what you would inherently think they would be. A duty of loyalty. You can't be unfaithful to a person you're working for. Okay? Because instantly then, that undercuts the relationship between the two of them. If I go out hiring you to buy a car, and you turn around looking for cars for other people at my expense, because you know they'll pay you more, guess what? That's not a good relationship, and you breached your duty of loyalty to me. Duty of obedience. If I tell you I need that car by Tuesday, and you don't pay attention to that and do it whenever you want to, again, you breached your duty to me. Okay? Duty of reasonable care. You have to do what I've asked you to do with a reasonable amount of care. Care that's reasonable under the circumstances. What a reasonable human being would do in that circumstance. Okay? So whatever I've asked you to do, you have to do it reasonably. Okay? Okay. Employment. How is employment different than agency? Some agents are employees. Some are not. One of the key differences is some agents aren't compensated. All employees are. Okay? An employee, simple definition, an act to engage or hire one's service in return for payment, compensation, for such service. State labor law defines it more simply. They say permitted or suffered. Sufferance is actually a legal term of art. To work. When you're an employee, that's different than an independent contractor. We'll get to that in a second. With respect to an independent contractor, they are doing something for you. An employee is doing something for you. How do you tell the difference? One simple thing. Your power as the one who hires them to control every aspect of their performance. If you control every aspect of the performance, how they do it, then that person's an employee. If you only have an agreement by which they have to do what you ask, but you don't control how they do it, and remember, it's a right to control, not whether you exercise that right. Okay? I may have the right to control it and don't supervise my employees. They're still employees. It's a right to do it. If I turn around and hire somebody to put on my roof, and I say, I don't care how you put on the roof, just go up there and put on the roof, and when you're done, I'll pay it. That person's an independent contractor. If I turn around and say, this is exactly what you'll do. You'll show up here at 9 o'clock in the morning. You'll work for 7 hours a day. You'll get a half hour of a break. I'm going to pay you $6 an hour, and I'm going to fill out all your employment forms. Guess what? That person's an employee. Okay? It's your control over that individual. Okay? Remember, right to control. Okay. New York State is an employment and will state. That is a very important concept because under New York State law, we're one of the few states in the country that has this designation. That means you can hire or fire someone for any reason or no reason whatsoever as long as it's not an unlawful reason. I can fire you because I don't like the fact that you wear orange on Tuesdays. I can turn around and hire you because I like the fact you wear green shoes. It doesn't matter what the reason is. Now, under federal and state laws, I can't fire you because of your nationality or your marital status or your religion There's certain suspect classes that you're not allowed to do under the civil rights law of the federal government and the state human rights law. Okay? Now, there's also another caveat to that, an exception, and that's if we have an employment contract in writing. A written employment contract will allow that person to be able to either be retained instead of fired or have severance as a result. They'll get a severance payment. Okay? If it's unclear whether it's an employment contract, courts have imposed that other documents, such as an employee handbook, can constitute an employment contract. It's on a case-by-case basis. Okay? There's certain laws, as we've talked about, that provide for equal opportunity in employment. These do not say you have to hire that person. What they say is there's certain circumstances that society, and I think this is a good thing, has said that you cannot turn around and discriminate on that basis. Okay? It's a federal civil rights law, state human rights law. Under the federal law, it constitutes race, color, religion, sex, national origin, age, gender, disability, and pregnancy. Under the state human rights law, it's age, race, creed, color, national origin, sexual orientation, military status, sex, marital status, or disability. The state is actually a little bit broader than the federal government. Okay. Now, labor unions. Under federal law, you have a right in the private sector. Private sector. That means non-government. To collectively bargain. You can form a labor union, you can join a labor union, then you can collectively bargain. There are certain exceptions to that, but by and large, you can do that. You have the right to do that unless the government allows you to do it with government. Matter of fact, you may remember, actually none of you here would remember because you're too young, but in 1980, President of the United States fired all the air traffic controllers across the nation because their labor union refused to allow them to come to work. So he fired all of them. Why was that done? Because under federal law, there is no right to have a labor union for you unless the government allows it. New York State, we have passed a state statute which allows collective bargaining for governmental employees. It's called the Taylor Law. That statute does two things. It allows you to join a labor union, which allows them to collectively bargain for you, and it allows the state of New York to actually put you in jail if you strike. So in return for giving the employees the right to collectively bargain, they also imposed upon them a right not to strike. Okay? Superimposed over all of these are health and safety laws. You have federal organizations and state organizations that state how many hours you can work a week under certain professions. They don't do that for law. They do it for other things. Okay? If you're a truck driver, you can only drive so many hours because it's viewed as health and safety. Certain nursing professions allows how many hours you can work. The standardized work week is 40 hours a week, but some people work far more than that. But you also have health standards under things like OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. If all of a sudden they come into your factory and find out you have too much dust in there and it's not safe to breathe, they can put fines and close it down. Okay? Regulate things like workplace conditions, minimum wages, and hours of employment. Okay. Part 3. Remember, the history of the law is important. It's important to know where you've been in order to know where you're going. Law, as we know it today, started in Rome. It was the first society to lay down a structure of law on how a society would be ordered. And one of the critical things it did was to recognize for the first time in human history a issue of continuity. What does that mean? It means that they recognize that the law, their society, and yes, business, should not end in one human lifetime, or even in the lifetime of everybody you know. It should be perpetual, go on forever. It's why they invented the corporation. Because the corporation's existence, if you remember, is perpetual. Can be. They wanted their businesses to have a lifetime beyond that of a person. And they looked to that. Romans viewed their society as eternal. Okay? That led to developments not only in law, but also developments as well in business. Okay. Remember that the very word corporation comes from Latin, comes from Rome. Corpus, meaning body. Separate person under the law. It was that concept that we're going to create this artificial person, and that person's going to go on and live forever and be able to do things outside of a person's life. Our law evolved from England. English common law, and remember, England evolved from Rome because they were a Roman colony. Okay, they had a great deal of respect for the law. And remember, King Henry was the guy who turned around and built the common law. He took the concept of feudalism, which was brought to England by William the Conqueror, his predecessor, several years before him. He took those reciprocal duties of feudalism and applied it in the law, in helping to build a system that not only reflected the development of the law, but also the concept of private property rights. Those reciprocal duties, what the government owes to you, and what you owe to the government, and intertwine your legal relationships, led to the development of what we call rights today. Rights are our most sacred concept in the law. And they came out of this English duty-to-duty relationship. Matter of fact, they fought a war to be able to get them. Those of you who may remember the Magna Carta. It was signed as a result of a battle of Runnymede. I went to Washington last week and saw the Magna Carta. I wanted to see it for a long time. Magna Carta was signed to give rights to freemen. Now, freemen was not everybody back then, but when we signed the American Constitution and adopted it, we took the Magna Carta to the next step because we gave rights to everybody. Well, almost everybody. We had to fight a civil war to get them to everybody. We amended our Constitution to do that. That's where those rights came from. And they were an evolution. They didn't happen all at once. Okay? Okay. When colonial America came, remember colonial America? Colonial America was pretty wealthy. We had a lot of land. That's one of the reasons why everybody came here. Because in Europe, where most of the people who came here were from originally, they didn't have a lot of land. Moreover, it was tied up in family inheritances. You had primogeniture, which means your land went to the firstborn son of your family. If you weren't the firstborn son, you were out of luck. So you come to America and they have all this land. It became a wealthy country. And farmers, which was the first sole proprietors, operated businesses and merchant classes arose. They were sole proprietors by and large, a few partnerships here and there. Almost no corporations yet, but there were a few. Remember, some of the first corporations resulted from coming to America, where the royalty actually bestowed a corporate charter on individuals wanting to come here as an incentive for them to come over. Okay? Okay. Remember, the corporation was originally bestowed on you by a regal charter. The king would actually hand you a charter, a piece of paper. That charter became what we would call today the Certificate of Incorporation, which allowed you to incorporate. It gave you the limited liability of a corporation we know today. That limited liability came from the king. It was a delegation of his sovereign immunity. Well, after we fought a revolution in this country, we weren't so fond of kings. We didn't have one. So America decided, did it through statute, that the way, and constitutions, the way that we create corporations is by an act of state legislatures. They're the ones who replaced the kings,
because we didn't have, particularly the first time of the Revolution, we didn't have a national government yet.
Articles of Confederation was a group of states working together. National government didn't have any power. And when we wrote the Constitution, we didn't authorize the federal government to charter corporations. There's nothing in there about the federal government creating corporations.
There's language about the federal government respecting the rights of corporations as a separate person under the law, but no authority to have the federal government do it.
We talked about the case of McCulloch versus Maryland,
involving the bank in the United States, where Congress took it upon themselves to actually issue a corporate charter.
And the Supreme Court of the United States said, under limited circumstances, for the purposes of helping the federal government, we'll allow you to do it.
But by and large, the corporate creation power rested in the states.
And remember, it rested by after the state legislature. I wanted to create Bob's Donuts. I wanted to go out and make donuts in colonial America or soon thereafter the Revolution. I had to go to the state legislature and have them pass a special law to allow me to incorporate. That's how I got my corporate charter. Now,
around 1840, thereabouts,
people said, this is really dumb. Business is booming in America. All across the United States, including New York, which had just built the Erie Canal, so things were swimming.
New York said, we need to get more business entities going on here. And corporations, that's the greatest thing since sliced bread. We need to get more of them.
And it's silly to bring the state legislature all together to pass a law every time they wanted to start a new corporation. So they passed one law. It was called the General Incorporation Statute, that allowed you to create a corporation if you met certain requirements. That's the delegation of the corporation power by the state to an entity, which was the Secretary of State, to create these corporations if certain legal requirements in law are met. Okay? 1846, that was the year. Okay?
Okay.
Now, 1929 comes along. There's almost no federal corporations. Federal government doesn't get involved in any of this stuff. And even today, they're light on it. But we'll talk about that in a minute. 1929 comes along, and you see a stock market crash. People are jumping out of windows. The depression starts. The federal government has a national debate in Congress saying, you know what, in 1933, 4 years after that, we have to take action to regulate marketable securities. That's shares of stock. That's corporate finance. Because that's what's traded on the stock market. And they said that the stock market trades the way that they were doing, they're selling stuff left and right on the stock exchange, trading shares of a corporation, was too loose. No oversight.
Sound familiar?
1929, shouldn't have happened, they said, but there was more oversight. 1933, they passed the Securities Act of 1933, and the federal government creates a Security and Exchange Commission that says any publicly traded corporation, that's not most corporations, that's a small amount of corporations, because most corporations, like most businesses, are small. But if you are a GM, if you are a GE, a big mama corporation where you sell your stock on the public exchange, Securities and Exchange Commission governs what you have to do in order to do it fairly, properly, and transparently. That was created in 1933. Several amendments had occurred to it after that, and most recently, in the late 1990s, when WorldCom happened, which was a big company that had a stock scandal, and then more recently, just a few years ago, the federal government passed two additional statutes. One was known as Sarbanes-Oxley, that was in response to WorldCom, and the second one was Dodd-Frank in response to what they envisioned the problems in the most recent financial crisis. A lot of people think that that actually made things worse. I think the tale will be told as we go along. We'll see. Okay. vehicles of business organization, individual proprietorships, remember, still the vast majority of businesses, partnerships, corporations. What do you have at corporations? You have business corporations, professional corporations, public benefit corporations, LLCs, limited liability companies, and then you have organizations, which aren't a corporate. You have specialized forms of business organizations. Joint ventures. What's a joint venture? That is basically a partnership for a one-time event. Okay? It's a singularity, but it's a specialized form. You have unincorporated associations and cooperatives. Again, they really don't have any form under the law. They operate through their principles. And when I say principles, it's not a principal and agency relationship. They operate through their membership, I should say. Okay? Membership, not principles. Franchises. What's a franchise? I create Bob's Donuts. And Bob's Donuts is a great business model. We make awesome business, and we make awesome donuts based on my grandma's recipe. We come together, and everybody in this room now says, you know, if I brought Bob's Donuts to my city near me, guess what? I'd make a ton of money. So I decide that I'm not going to sell my business to you. I'm not going to sell shares of stock to you. I'm going to sell my business model to you. And I'm going to give you the recipe. I'm going to show you how the standards are that I run Bob's Donuts. And I'm going to allow you to use the name Bob's Donuts. And by doing that, you pay me a fee. You get to use the name, you get to use the procedures, and run your business independently. It's not a corporation model. You're not part of a corporation that I control. What I control to you is the procedures and sell you that. Those are known as franchises. Okay? Franchises frequently are in the entertainment food industry. You have things like Starbucks, McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, certain gas stations. Okay? They do not include big corporations that may be global or nationwide. GE is not a franchise. Okay? They do not turn around and break that off that way. What they do is they sell directly on it. Okay? Walmart, IBM, private companies like Price Chopper. Price Chopper Supermarkets has 130 stores, but their stores are all owned by one company. Okay? Stop like those components. Okay. Franchises. That's franchises. Okay. We're now on to proprietorships and partnerships. We're almost home. Part four. Sole proprietorships. A sole proprietorship is a business established, owned, and controlled by a single person. If I turn around and only want to operate one Bob's Donut shop with all my friends and family, guess what? I don't want to incorporate. Don't want any of that hassle. Just want to put up a sign with my mug on it, Bob's Donuts. Nobody's come, but good idea. Sole proprietorships come in all shapes and sizes based on the individual entrepreneur. Okay? That person realizes all the gain and all the loss, all the risk and all the benefit. Okay? It is the most prominent form of all the four forms of ownership. What's a DBA? DBA is an abbreviation for doing business as. I go down to the local government and say, I want to operate Bob's Donuts in your locality. I want to register with your local clerk as Bob's Donuts. Bob Farley, give him my address, give him my phone number. This is where you call if you got a problem. That can register so that a person up the road, Bob Fitzsimmons, doesn't turn around and create his own Bob's Donuts. I can basically reserve the name for that locality only. Okay? It's not a nationwide thing. It's not a statewide thing. It's only for that locale. I got to file a small fee. It's a registration fee I got to do regularly. And as a result of that, I get to operate as a doing business as. Okay? I can be a corporation doing this. Okay, but there's no need to do that, because once I get my corporation name, guess what? Nobody else can take it. Matter of fact, some people go out and make money by just reserving a whole bunch of names. That was frequently done when people actually went out and bought names for the internet. They bought domain names that they thought were wonderful and then turned around and sold them. Okay? You incorporate, and even in pre-incorporation, you can reserve the name for a period of time. If you incorporate, nobody else can take that corporation's name. But if you don't incorporate, just want to operate a partnership or a sole proprietorship, you can do a DBA. Partnership. Partnerships are governed under New York State law under the Uniform Partnership Act. It's called partnership law under New York State law. It defines a partnership as an association of two or more persons, need at least two to make a partnership. And remember, the other one does not have to be a natural person. Okay? You can be a partner with a corporation. Okay? To carry on as co-owners of a business for profit. It includes registered limited liability partnerships. Remember, what a limited partner is a person who the other partners agree is only responsible for their investment. It takes that page out of a corporation with limited liability by agreement of other partners. Basically, they do it by indemnification. Okay? Remember, joint venture is a partnership. Okay? Partnership for one time. Okay, a partnership's not a legal entity under the law. Remember, a corporation, corpus, body, is a person. It's an artificial person under the law. A partnership is not. There are exceptions under the law, like there is for everything. A partnership can hold title and land in a partnership name, but it's a legal fiction. They allow it to do that just on the basis of the fact that the name can hold it, but literally under that same section of law, the partners are the ones who are legally responsible for it. Partners have to pay the taxes. The partners have to go out there and buy the liability insurance. Lawsuits, also the CPLR, the Civil Practice Law and Rules, allows you to sue in the name of a partnership. The thing about that is, that is a legal fiction because you have to serve the partners. You can't just serve the partnership. You have to physically serve a partner. So unlike a corporation where you can serve a secretary, you can't do that with a partnership. You got to track down who the partners are and serve them. So unless you hand them a copy of the lawsuit or do substitute service on it, you cannot sue the partnership. Corporation, they have agents out there. You can basically serve anybody who's an appointed agent. And you sue a corporation in the name of that corporation. That's the only people. Okay? Okay. Partnership agreements. Remember, not all partnership agreements have to be in writing. They can be oral. Only those which cannot, by their terms, be performed within a year must be in written form. That has to do with the statute of frauds. If they are can't be performed within a year. Now, if you don't know how long it takes, it can be oral. Okay? Even if you think there's no way it could possibly be done within a year, if there is a way that it could be, you don't have to have it in writing. Most partnership agreements are not in writing. But, like we advise everything else, put it in writing, helps you a lot. If you want to do anything in the law, make sure it's in writing. Okay. Partnership agreements, remember, if they are in writing, got to be signed by the party to be charged. That's the person you want to sue. Okay. Illegal activities, as in with all agency principal relationships. And remember, partners are agents and principals for each other. Okay? A partnership form for a legal activity will not be recognized under New York State law. When you go to dispose of the property, unless you have a partnership or other agreement that says to the contrary, it gets split equally among the partners. So even if you've had one partner who put in 95% of the money, when you go to divide up the partnership property that you've spent that money on behalf of the business, everything gets done 50-50. Or one-third, one-third, one-third if there's three of them, okay? It's equal shares unless the agreement says otherwise. Now, if you put in 90% of the money, what do you think you do, Chris?
You better get it in writing, right? Why? Because that protects you. If you have it orally, it's awful hard to prove, isn't it? presumed to be equal shares. So if you put in more money than the average bear, make sure it's in writing,
because then you can distribute it in any way you want. Okay? Partnership relations. This is not a newfangled way to describe marriage. This is the establishment of the partnership. Each of them owe a fiduciary duty to each other, a right to participate in the management of the business. Each one has the right to do that. Now, limited partners don't. In return for having that limited liability, they don't have that right, unless you give it to them. Each partner has a right to distributions. When the partnership goes, they get whatever is distributed. Okay? Okay. Law of agency under partnerships, the legal authority of a partner to bind the partnership when dealing with third parties is, of course, governed by the law of agency. Each one is an agent and a principal for each other. Special item. We talked very briefly on this. Imputed knowledge.
It is a legal fiction, but it is held nonetheless. If I am a partner, anything I know is imputed. That means is found to legally be with my other partner.
So if I know something, the other partner is held to that knowledge. If you turn to me and tell me that you better not put this chemical into Bob's donuts or people will get hurt because it causes huge allergies amongst people with green hair. And my partner, I don't tell him that because I said the number. Green hair. I don't tell my partner that. He puts the chemical in. Someone with green hair then comes out and sues him. Guess what? He's deemed to have known that because I did. Called imputed knowledge. Whatever one partner knows, the other partner is deemed to know. Why? Because under the doctrine of duty, I have a duty to inform him of those types of things. So this perpetuates that duty. Dissolution. How can a partnership go away? How can it be dissolved? Two ways. After the partners, they can agree, they can expel one of the partners, mutual assent, or by operation of law. One of the partners dies. Illegal activity. Bankruptcy. Okay. Major partnerships. What are some examples of some major partnerships out there? Big law firms have hundreds of employees. Okay? Skadden Arps in New York City. Okay? 600 employees. Big law firms, actually 600 lawyers, probably more employees. Big four accounting firms. Okay? KPMG, that's a partnership. Okay? Many major movie production firms are actually partnerships because they know they'll go away quick. And they just form them and break them. Okay. Corporations. Business corporations, foreign and domestic, closed and publicly traded, professional, subchapter S. What's a subchapter S corporation? Subchapter S is when I own a small business and I do incorporate, but I want is a provision of the IRS, the Internal Revenue Code, that allows the taxes of that corporation to be taxed as individual. Okay? If I'm a subchapter S, I'm allowed to be taxed the same as if I was a sole proprietorship. Okay? There are certain rules for a subchapter S. I can't have a whole bunch of people there. It's basically me, and I incorporate for liability purposes. Public benefit corporations. Those are corporations chartered by act of the state legislature for the purpose of doing a public benefit. MTA runs the subway systems. They're a public authority. They're public benefit corporations. Okay? Federal government has done some of these things, not many. Give you an example. Probably most of you won't know this, but it's something called the Tennessee Valley Authority, done by Franklin Roosevelt to bring electricity across the center part of the country, primarily the Appalachians. TVA is a federal public authority. Okay? A couple of commissions are also federal public authorities you may not know about. Atomic Energy Commission, things like that. Okay. Municipalities. Municipalities are actually corporations. They're chartered by the state government. Matter of fact, a lot of them were actually chartered by the king. The city of Albany was chartered regally. Okay? That's how it came in. That's why you talk about a municipal charter, they started as a corporation. Then lastly, you have not-for-profit corporation. Okay. Big, long definition. Guess what?
Do you think that I would put this on the test?
Way too long. Okay? Know that a corporation is an artificial person. Okay? That big, long definition is when you get tired one night, you read it, and fall asleep, makes you feel better. Okay. You need to know it's an artificial person created in accordance with statutes. Couple characteristics of corporations you need to keep in mind. The limited liability of corporations. A shareholder, that's how you have ownership of the corporation, is limited only to their investment. So only the money you use to purchase those shares is the only money you're going to lose. That's the whole concept of limited liability. Like the law has every place else, there are exceptions, but that's one of them. Entity powers. The corporation is a person under the law, so it can do things in its own name. When it says entity powers, that's what it means. It acts of its own accord. It does it through a board of directors elected by the shareholders, but the entity itself takes action. It has centralized management. That's the board of directors, who is elected by the shareholders, and that board of directors directs, that's why they're all directors, created people in these corporation creators. Board of directors directs the officers of the corporation, which are the president, the secretary, all those people who are officers, to do things on behalf of it. Got centralized management. Got a continuity of existence. Remember, corporations are either formed in perpetuity, forever, or for a specified period of time. They don't just come and go. They're not like a sole proprietorship where one day you decide that you're going to build a spaceship. Okay? Corporations have permanence. That's by their very nature. Okay? It can freely transfer its interests. Remember, it's a person under the law. And it has statutory, that means under statute, sources of authority. What it can do is prescribe within its certificate of incorporation pursuant to state law. Now, there's some federal laws out there, too, particularly if you're publicly traded. Okay? A corporation also has a constitutional status as a person. It does have rights, but it's not a natural person. So it doesn't have all of our liberties. Okay? The corporation status under the Constitution, states that it is an artificial person under the law, not a natural. Okay? Now, this became a big issue just last year when you had a court case with Citizens United that turned around and said that corporations have free speech rights. Supreme Court of the United States found that they did. Okay? It's distinguished from other business organizational forms, obviously. Different than a partnership, okay, where the partners each have a voice in its direct management. A shareholder doesn't. Shareholder has a voice in the management of the corporation, same way a voter has a voice in the management of an elected body. Okay? You elect the shareholder, you elect the board of directors, and they're the ones who manage the corporation. You get a vote, or many votes, depending on the number of shares you hold, but you cannot directly manage it unless you're also a member of the board of directors, which you can do. Okay? You can elect yourself. Okay? What is a business corporation? Under New York State law, there's all kinds of different corporations out there, as we said. A business corporation, which is defined in Section 201 of the Business Corporation Law, is a private corporation that is established to conduct a business for profit. It's limited in its liability to the shareholders. Limited liability, remember, that comes from the king, sovereign immunity. It was an incentive for capital investment. You would be more likely to give that entity, that corporation, money if you knew that you wouldn't end up in debtor's prison if it went south. Traditionally, the law held if you got involved in a business and it went bankrupt, you had to pay everything. Even if you only gave them $100, they could take your house, they could take your horse, they could take everything. And if they had more debts out there, they could put you in prison. this concept came up to say, hey, listen, we need you to invest in this idea. You would be hesitant under the previous set of laws to do that. Because you say, I like my house, I like my horse, I don't want to go to prison, so I'm not going to give you the $100. Under this model, the king said, nope, all you'll lose is the $100. Get to keep your house, get to keep your horse, nobody's going to go bug you. Okay? That limited liability exploded capitalism, made it go absolutely bonkers because of the fact now you had free sources of capital. Okay? That capital investment really came into line when limited liability came up. Okay. Corporation characteristics, again, limited liability, has entity powers and centralized management, continuity of existence, and statutory sources of authority. Pre-incorporation activities. If I'm a promoter, that's somebody who's trying to establish a corporation. Okay? The activities necessary to establish the corporation or the business in which it'll engage can be ratified by adoption of the board of directors after the corporation's established. Okay? So if I'm doing some things beforehand, I'm going to incorporate Bob's Donuts, but I went out and I bought a whole bunch of flour because we launch Bob's Donuts, we want to launch it with a bag, have lots of donuts when we launch it. That corporation could turn around and then pay me back for the amount of money that I spent buying the wheat. Okay? Flour. Formation of a corporation, what do? You have to have incorporators. They're natural people. They have to be natural people. Under or over 18, which is the age of majority, they have to prepare a certificate of incorporation. And it has to conform with that state statute that provides for the requirements. Has to tell the name, has to tell the address, designate a purpose of the corporation, has to state who you're going to be able to serve if you want to sue it. All those items have to go in there. You have to file that certificate of incorporation with the Office of Secretary of State. And this is the big deal, you have to pay all the fees. And in New York State, there's a boatload of fees. You want to incorporate, guess what? Reach in, grab the wallet, because there's a lot of them. Okay? What's the difference between a foreign and a domestic corporation? It's not overseas. It's out of state. If you are a domestic corporation, that means you're incorporated in New York State. Okay? You don't even have to have your offices in New York State, but you're incorporated here. Give an example. General Electric Company is a New York State corporation. Their corporate headquarters are in Connecticut. They used to be in Schenectady. They're in Connecticut today. They are a domestic corporation because they're incorporated in New York. Okay? A foreign corporation doesn't have to be Hyundai in China or Japan or something. It can be right here. A foreign corporation can be in the United States. It's just not in New York State and just not incorporated. Again, that corporation could have its offices here and be incorporated in Delaware. It's still a foreign corporation. Okay? Corporate ownership, your interest in the corporation is represented by shares of stock. That determines the number of votes you get for the board of directors. It determines your ownership interest. That stock is sold for a specified amount of money, and you buy that. Holding those shares makes you own the corporation. Shares can be different. We'll talk about this next time. But voting shares allow the shareholder to elect members of the board of directors and control certain directions of corporate policy. Some things actually come up to the board or come up to shareholders for a vote. 99.5% of the management of the corporation, however, goes through the board of directors. Okay? You get to vote for them. That's what you get when you own a share. Okay? Got to be a voting share, common stock to do it. Limitation on investment. Remember, you only are limited to the amount that you pay for that stock. Monies used to purchase the shares of stock is inherently the limit of the exposure of the investor. Shares so purchased gives investors certain rights with respect to the corporation, as we said. Now, there are exceptions to limited liability called piercing the corporate veil. What happens if you create a corporation as a shill, not a shell, but a shill, which says You're doing it for fraudulent purposes.
You're the only one who has shares in the corporation. The corporation does things that are personal only to you. You go well beyond what corporate purposes are.
It is a subterfuge. And that corporation does something bad to someone,
they can sue not only the corporation, they can sue you. It's known as piercing the corporate veil. It is done to prevent fraud.
If you turn around and use a corporation for the purposes of fraud, they can go after it.
It's fraud and misconduct that this focuses.
And limited liability can get pierced where they can take your horse and your house and your cow and your car. Okay. Professional corporations.
What's a professional corporation? I'm a lawyer. If I get together with six other lawyers and we decide to form a corporation for the express and exclusive purpose of practicing law, we can do that. But everyone who owns stock in that corporation has to be a lawyer.
Why? Because under the professional corporation statute that we would incorporate under, you have to be a licensed professional within that profession to incorporate under that professional corporation.
You can also do it if you're a doctor with a bunch of doctors. You can also do it with a bunch of nurse practitioners if you're a nurse practitioner. All the engineers can come together, but an engineer and a lawyer can't. Okay? You have to do it as that profession.
Now, just this past year, there's discussions about bringing chiropractors and doctors into the same practice. A lot of controversy. I think it's still going to happen. Okay. Closed and publicly traded corporations.
If I form a corporation, Bob Stodas, and I only want friends and family to own the shares,
I'm not interested in going on the stock market.
I know it'll never be that big a deal. So only my friends and family will be allowed to buy the shares.
Nobody else.
I don't want anybody else involved in it.
Just us. That's a closed corporation.
Price Chopper Supermarkets. That is a closed corporation. It's owned by the Golden family and their employees.
That's the only people who can buy stock. If you're a publicly traded corporation, anybody can buy the stock. Anybody, as long as you're over 18 years of age, you can buy the stock. Okay? And by doing that, you are subjecting yourselves to certain rules. Publicly traded corporations are regulated by the SEC. Closed corporations are not. Okay, any questions? Any questions whatsoever? Hold on, before you go, we have a question of the day. What is it?
What percentage of the population are born on leap year?
That was a question only he could get. He's a leap year, give it up.